Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're sharing good news stories, acts of kindness or connection that wouldn't necessarily make news headlines. And our next story is about a little bit of bad news that became something beautiful. The Emmert family of Des Moines had a big, beautiful tree in their backyard, a tree that was used for swings and other things. But when it came time for the tree to come down, Patrick Emmert had an idea. He decided to make a violin out of the wood for his daughter, Natalie. Patrick and Natalie are here with me now. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, Charity.
And hello, Natalie.
Hi.
Natalie, tell me a little bit about this tree. What do you remember about it?
I remember that it was really tall, but the bark was starting to come off of it, so we thought it was time to take it down before it got dangerous.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you used to have a swing on this tree?
I still do. We left the bottom part, but I think we're going to take the rest of it down soon.
Yeah,
it's very much dying right now, and there was one arm of the tree that we left on about a 10-foot section that's currently there, but it's getting to the point where that's becoming dangerous.
Right. That doesn't sound very safe for swinging.
No.
So a lot of us have to take down a tree in our yard, but none of us, no one else, makes a violin out of it, I don't think. So tell me how this came about, Patrick. A big branch fell off the tree, and what happened?
Yeah. So after a storm, a big branch fell down, and because it was freshly broken wood, I could see that there was this red color inside the end of the branch that was on the ground, and I thought, hey, that might be throughout the whole tree. And there was a big branch that hung over our neighbor's driveway, and I didn't want that to fall in their car, so I knew the thing was going to come down sooner as opposed to later. So I kind of proclaimed, hey, Natalie, I will make you a violin out of that.
What was your reaction when your dad said that, Natalie?
I thought at first that he was a little bit crazy, but then I thought it would be a fun father-daughter project to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, first let's talk about the color. This is a box elder tree. Is that typical of a box elder tree? Would it have that beautiful red color inside?
No, actually, box elder trees are pretty much white inside. They're actually a reed that, if given the right conditions, can grow into a tree. And obviously had the right conditions in my backyard. But what happens is when they get stressed or they get injured in some way, the tree will react with I believe it's a bacteria or some sort of organic something. And when it starts to kind of go bad, it has this red color that comes out in that. So as the tree dies from the center out, the red travels from the middle out. And depending on what phase the tree is at throughout that process, depends on how much red is actually in that wood. But it's basically a sick tree that causes the red to come out.
Huh, interesting. So now it sounds a little crazy for you to say, I'm going to make my daughter a violin, but it's not quite as crazy for you to say that as it might be for someone else to
right.
say that, because
right.
you are a guitar maker as
I
your
am.
Profession, right?
Yeah, I'm the head luthier at Built Guitars in Des Moines. And I went to school in Red Wing, Minnesota, to the college up there. So it's kind of what I do.
When you decided to make a violin, that's a very different kind of instrument. What was the learning process like to be able to figure out what you needed to do?
Yeah, well, at college, we learned how to copy instruments. So we would have an acoustic, and we would learn how to draw the plans out. And I kind of took that same concept and thought, well, I have my own violin, so let's just copy it and see how close we can get to the original. But yeah, what came out of it isn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But I just did whatever research I needed to do to learn about the bracing and sound post and where to put it and so on.
And Natalie, you had been playing the violin for, what, a couple of years at this point?
I think it was 3 years when we got it done.
All right. And what kind of instrument had you been playing on?
It was my dad's old violin.
It was a dime store violin that I just bought. I think it was probably just a cheap knockoff of something. And I told her, borrow it. I'm not playing it. So that's what she used. And that kind of spurred on why I wanted to do it in the first place. Because I thought if I could take the talents that I've got, through schooling and through experience and apply it to my kid, then she can have her own violin, something that she can take with her and have with her after, rather than borrowing dad's piece of junk violin.
Well, and so you're 12 years old now, Natalie. Did you build a full-size violin?
Yes, I actually started with a full-size violin, which was not a very smart idea, but...
That's challenging, sure. Okay, well, in the end, that may turn out to be a really great thing.
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to build this violin?
Well, we cut down the tree and then put it in the basement for a year to dry out the wood. It has to dry out and get all the sap and liquids out of it.
But then, yeah, after about a year, a little less than a year, we took it to the shop, and I don't know, what did it take, about a week?
Yeah, probably.
About a week. Evenings, after hours, I have a full-time job, so I didn't do anything till the evenings. But yeah, 5 o'clock hit, I went home, got her, brought her back to the shop, and we worked until bedtime.
And how much of the work did you actually do, Natalie? Did he let you do quite a bit?
Quite a bit, yeah. I helped design some of the different features on the violin, the scroll on the top, and then the sound holes on the actual body of the violin. And then I sanded the scroll and the neck.
So what kind of wood are violins normally made out of?
Normally the top is, well, I should say traditionally, the top is spruce, and the back and sides are traditionally maple. The neck is usually maple. The fingerboard would be made of ebony, the tuning pegs, the chin rest, and the tailpiece, I guess. I should probably know the right terms, and all the violinists out there are screaming at me right now. Those are all made of ebony. The bridge is typically carved out of maple also.
So were you concerned at all about the kind of sound you'd get out of the instrument, given that you weren't using the traditional woods?
Oh, yeah. I knew I could not get the top as thin as you can with spruce. It's called strength to weight ratio, and spruce is one of the highest out there, and I have no idea what box elder wood is, so I just kind of started taking out material on the inside until it was a comfortable flex, if you will. Moving the wood around and tapping it and just seeing, okay, if I've got X number of pounds worth of pressure on the top of this thing, is it going to cave in or is it going to take it? So there's a little design work in there.
All right. And how did you finish it?
I just finished it with nitrocellulose lacquer, stuff that we put on our guitars in the shop. It was just there in the booth, and I was put a couple of coats on it to keep it protected from the elements. Traditionally, they use a shellac, I believe. And we just don't have any of that, so it's a very, very non-traditional instrument.
Now, we're going to share a picture of this on our Facebook page, but Natalie, describe for me what the instrument looks like, because it's very unique and it's beautiful.
Yes, I'm going to start and go from the top to the bottom. The scroll is not traditional. It is actually hollow in the center, where normally it would be one solid piece. And then the neck is the same piece as the head, but the fingerboard is it's very much a darker red than the rest of the instrument. And then the body is mostly white with some red stripes going through it. Same with the back. And then the sides, I believe, are made from the same portion of the tree as the fingerboard, so they are a darker red color with some white. And then the sound holes are not traditional. They are like normal sound holes on a violin. They just don't have they taper off instead of going into a little circle at the end. And then the chin rest and the tuning pegs are all store-bought.
Okay. And you're going to play it for us in a little while, but how does it sound?
It sounds pretty good. But it sounds a lot better now than it did when we made it.
Yeah.
Okay, tell me about that.
Yeah, so it was a little stiff when we first started. There wasn't a whole lot of low end. And from my experience at college, the more you play something, the more it opens up.
Okay.
Because she has orchestra, she gets to play it quite a few times a week.
2 to 3 times a week, yeah. For about an hour.
So it's had some exercise.
Well, and how did your orchestra teacher respond to this violin?
Well, she was the last one to come into the classroom, but when she did, she called me up to the front of the class saying, "Natalie, you got to share this."
Oh, wow.
Which I had already told most of the people, and they they wanted to play it really badly.
Yeah. Well, would you play a little something for us?
Sure.
Wonderful. So have you done like a side-by-side comparison, Natalie, with your other violin?
No, I haven't.
But you're happy with how this sounds.
But yes, I'm very happy. Yeah. It's much better than the old one.
Well, it's wonderful. And this was clearly a very special project for the two of you. Patrick, what do you think? What do you think you got out of this experience?
Definitely a lifelong memory. I love my daughter a lot, and to be able to do projects with her, anything from just working on school, going to her concerts, just hanging out with her on a day-to-day basis. This was just one step above and beyond, one more thing that we could do together that, you know, she can have forever. And she can even pass it down, both the violin and the story, to her kids.
Yeah. What does it mean to you, Natalie, that your dad made this for you and that it comes from a tree that was in your backyard?
I know that I'm never going to forget it, but I think that I am probably going to pass it down to my children.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to live in our family for generations.
And Patrick, you made a video about the making of this violin. And one of the things that you shared in the video was that it made you think about The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein.
Yes, absolutely. Just that story and being a kid and hearing that. And then going through this, that was, I just identified with that story of that tree where the kid goes and takes parts of it all through its life. There is still a 10-foot stump in our backyard that's going to come down. I fully intend on making a video of taking that thing down and using it to some capacity.
Oh, well, thank you both so much for sharing your story today. And happy holidays.
You too.
Patrick and Natalie Emmert talking about the violin they made together. More stories of kindness and connection to come. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're sharing good news stories, acts of kindness or connection that wouldn't necessarily make news headlines. Pat Kinney wrote for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for many years and is now the Korean War Content Development Specialist at the Grout Museum District in Waterloo. This put him in a unique position to help a veteran in need and to witness the kindness of many others in responding to this need. Pat, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Charity. It's nice to be here.
Well, and I think a lot of us, when we think about a veteran in need, the idea that pops into our head would be someone in recent service or maybe reaching back to the Vietnam or Korean Wars. But you learned about a World War II veteran who was in real trouble. Tell me what was going on.
Well, Kevin Dill, our Blackhawk County Veteran Affairs Director, put out an advisory to folks that he had received referral on a World War II veteran who had found himself suddenly homeless. They didn't have couldn't line up a grant for some permanent residence. They needed to put him up in a motel for several days, up to a week actually, until they could secure the grant. And he put out word to everybody. And I saw the email, and like you, I said, "Wow, World War II. Youngest of those folks are in their early 90s." So I sent out an email to everybody at the museum district and said, "Hey, Kevin's got this guy. If you want to chip in, you know, let him know." And like, it happened instantly. I mean, like within about 10 minutes, Bob Niemeyer, our historian, walks in, hands me a $20 bill and says, "Well, here you go if you're taking collections." And I said, "Well, I didn't think I was, but I guess I am now." And everybody in the museum just chipped in. Billy Bailey, our director, said, "I'll write you a check." And, you know, there was another person who had family, military, and they gave money and food. And our new development director, Nikki Litzel, used to work at the Salvation Army in Waterloo, and she lined up a big box of food for the guy. It was like the size of a college dorm refrigerator, and it was about just as heavy. So we raised a bunch of cash and the food, and I took it out to the County Veteran Affairs office to Kevin and his staff. And then the next day, every Wednesday, we have a veterans coffee, and we usually get about 2 or 3 dozen vets there, all branches of services, all conflicts. And our receptionist said, well, why don't you go down and ask the guys if they want to chip in? So I took an envelope down there and told the guys what was going on and passed it, and boy, they filled it like nothing. One of the guys said, this is what we do. We take care of other vets. So between us and a nonprofit in Waterloo called Americans for Independent Living, we covered the guy's temporary stay at a motel. Meanwhile, Kevin procured a grant to get him in permanent placement at Walnut Court Apartments. It's a old, really nice older apartment complex on the east side of Waterloo. And I checked last week, and as far as I know, the guy's comfortable. He's good, you know, but we gave him the bridge, you know, to have a place to stay until they could line everything up for him.
Absolutely. Well, and the response of everyone that you talked to about this need was overwhelming. What was your reaction? What were you thinking when everyone you talked to opened their wallet and wanted to make a difference?
It was just a reflex. Everybody just automatic. And, you know, and I guess I kind of reacted that way too. It's like, you know, this is not right. This guy needs to be put up. It didn't matter how it happened. You know, it's not right. The guy's World War II vet. He served our country. He's got to have a place to stay. There's just no two ways about it. And everybody else was the same way. And then I got a call from a fellow, Pat Cook, he's with Sons of American Legion in Waterloo, invited me to a Veterans Day lunch they were having that weekend. It was November 10th. And I said, well, I'm going to be out of town, but did you hear about this World War II vet? They took him over there, and they gave him a big meal, and they raised more money for him there. And it was just, I mean, you just did it. It's the right thing to do, and there wasn't any question about it.
Why do you think this resonated so strongly for you? I mean, you've covered a lot of veterans' issues over the years, and that's what you're doing now for the Grout Museum District. But in your personal life, why do you think this touched you so much?
Well, it hits me on a couple different levels. My dad was a World War II veteran, and my mom is in her mid-90s and still in her own place and has some at-home care. So it hit me on a couple different levels because this fellow is of my dad's generation and means a lot to me.
This veteran is safe now and heading into an Iowa winter. He's safe and warm and comfortable. As someone who has been covering veterans' issues for a long time, of course, you know that we have a lot of veterans all over the country who are dealing with homelessness. What do you think we can take away from this situation? What should we be thinking about?
It should be a no-brainer, I guess. You know, this was a no-brainer for everybody that helped out, and you should be helping the folks that served our country, that put it on the line for all of us so we can have a good life. And it's not just the ones that have physical needs, but the ones that have mental needs too. You know, I know a lot of Iowa National Guard guys who served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and they're hurting, and they're trying to get on with their lives too. And they're not going to show those scars. Those are inside. We just need to kind of take care of these guys. They don't often talk about themselves. And when you see it, you know, it doesn't hurt to go out of your way and thank somebody for that. Just thank them or help them however you can.
Pat, thank you so much.
Thanks, Charity.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're sharing good news stories, acts of kindness or connection that wouldn't necessarily make news headlines.
When life is hard and the future looks dark, knowing that even one person believes in you can make a powerful difference. Jamie Ross went to prison when she was 16 years old and had a hard time seeing a positive future for herself when she was released. But a prison volunteer, Marty Civi, could see the potential in Jamie. Jamie's been out of prison for 15 years and has built a good life. She has a successful career, is a happy wife and mother of two, and she is here to share the story of this powerful connection. Jamie, thank you so much for talking with me today.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell me when you first met Marty.
Well, I met Marty in 1998. She started coming out to the prison in Mitchellville to volunteer as a drama director. She had been in some plays here in, locally, and she wanted to be able to give back. And so she came out there to see what she could do there.
So this was kind of a club at the prison that you could get involved in to be in a drama club?
Yep, it was a drama club. And you as funny as that sounds, you know, drama club in prison, there's enough drama as there is. But she came out, and at first we were all just going to be reading plays and seeing where that took us. And she was able to talk the prison into letting us actually put on plays.
What was your first impression when you met Marty?
Oh, she is a spitfire. She's she's just fun as can be, and you can just tell right away that she is genuine. She's, you know, is not going to feed you a bunch of crap. She's going to be honest with you, and you can tell she's been through a lot in her life, and that she really honestly cares about people.
Tell me how your relationship progressed. I mean, she was a volunteer. There were a lot of you in the group. How did you and she connect?
Well, after putting on a few plays there at the prison and being anywhere from on stage and, you know, having her also help me learn how to be a stage manager. And really, I do a lot of speaking engagements, and she is, to me, the whole reason why I can speak coherently in public, because I never was able to do that before. From taking me to, when she came in, I was 19 years old when I first met her, and she got it to where, you know, I would feel comfortable sharing deep things about my life on stage, and she made it a comfortable setting to where there was kind of like a no judgment zone. No matter what was going on in anybody's life, no matter what was going on while we were putting on these plays, she would give us time to process that and also use the plays as a way to draw some of that out of us and to help us process some of the situations that we've been through in our own life.
Up to that point in your life, had you ever had a connection with somebody like this?
You know, yes and no. A lot of us have a hard time accepting that people can love us unconditionally or even accept us for who we are and what we've done in our lives. Marty was definitely one of the first ones that I just felt was completely genuine, didn't want anything from us, and was able to see past our charges, see past our time, see past the worst day of our life, and see us for who we truly were. That was amazing, and it was amazing to be able to continue that friendship throughout the years as well.
Did the way that Marty saw you change the way you saw yourself?
Absolutely. I the way that Marty saw us, the way that she would see us, schedule us to do a part, you know, book us in that role, watch us go through it, watch us say, oh God, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't remember this, I'm not good enough for this, I'm not good enough for that. And mind you, most of us, especially by the time you make it to prison, we've been told we are not good enough over and over and over again. And to have her sit there and say, yeah, you can do it, yeah, you will do it, and to help build us up, in a way, it helped to change our own views. It's very hard it's very hard for inmates to actually see past all the labels that were given. And by her believing in us and by her, you know, holding us accountable and giving us something to focus on and giving us something to work towards and the confidence to do it, I mean, seriously, it changed my entire vision as to who I was and how I was going to be doing my time.
It's unusual for a relationship between a volunteer and a prisoner to endure past release, as you know, you moved out into the rest of your life. How did you maintain this relationship with Marty?
Well, Marty did a lot of work with the Chrysalis Foundation, and I was doing a lot of speaking engagements, and I still do. So I was doing some for after-school programs for youth, and she was able to keep in contact with me through that. When I first got out and I had a job, you know, she knew that I was doing okay and was able to kind of keep tabs on me that way. And when I was able to or ready to move on from that job, she was able to kind of push me in the right direction.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Okay, so I was working with the Animal Rescue League, and I absolutely love animals, and I loved everybody there, but I was ready to move on. You know, she called one day, and she said, you know, I really want you to go to this interview. And her ex-husband owns Real Optics, so it's Vogue Vision, One Hour Optical, Yonkers Optical, and iMart Optical. And I was, you know, I didn't know anything about eyes at all. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll go. And I went, and he hired me knowing that he was going to have to train me from the ground up. And the first week, I was absolutely terrified. I called Marty because I really did not want to do it. I felt so dumb because I didn't know anything about eyes. So when I called her and I cried and I'm like, Marty, are you going to be mad if I quit? I really want to quit. And she said, yes, I will be mad.
And, which is exactly what you needed to hear.
Exactly what I needed to hear. And so, you know, I just said, okay, fine, I'm going to make the best of this. And I decided to learn as much as I could. And I was surrounded by amazing people in 1 Hour Optical and throughout the entire company, really, that were able to teach me everything and then some. And, I mean, I worked my way from the ground up. Within a year, I was top sales in that branch. And that was just amazing to me that they could take somebody, and they literally took somebody who knew nothing and made something out of them. And, I mean, here
well,
it is.
Well, I think you get some of the credit for that as well. And that led to a thriving career.
Yeah, I mean, I've decided that, you know, I wanted to be more on the medical side of things. After working with Real Optics for 4.5 years, I was able to move a little bit more on the medical side and start doing more of the medical testing. Now I actually work for surgeons, and I'm an ophthalmic technician.
Well, I know that this conversation was actually sparked by a recent encounter that you and Marty had that kind of came about in a really lovely and beautiful way. She has returned to substitute teaching and wound up in one of your son's classrooms, right?
Yeah. So Marty decided that she was going to be a substitute teacher again and went in and was letting me know about it, and I was like, that's amazing, because really anybody that comes in contact with Marty, it's her energy is so healing, and there's so many kids nowadays that need that type of interaction with somebody. And my son came home telling me, oh God, I saw Miss Civi today. And I was like, what? And then she sends me this picture of her and my son, and I just, oh my God, my heart just leapt. I mean, I was only 9 years older than what my 10-year-old is right now when I first met her. And, you know, she's such an amazing person to be around, and I was so excited that my son would get to be around her, even if it is just when she is being a sub.
Marty obviously has been a very special woman in your life. Where do you think you'd be today if you hadn't encountered her?
Oh, that is such a hard question, because honestly, I can't even tell you. Like, I have a career that I absolutely love, and there's no way that I would have ever have applied for a job that I knew nothing about. And so everything that I do, I do a lot of speaking engagements, and I attribute that to being able to speak in public because of her. Without her, I don't know. I really don't know where I'd be working right now. I don't know what I'd be doing in my life. I really don't.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a lot to pay it forward, too. But Jamie, thank you so much for sharing your story with me.
Jamie Ross lives in Des Moines. Next up, a daughter remembers her father's unlikely friendship. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Neppe. This hour, we're sharing good news stories, acts of kindness or connection. And our next story is the story of an unlikely friendship. It's also the story of a daughter remembering her father. And it's a story that's gone viral in the past week, heard on NPR's Only a Game and Here and Now, and picked up by many, many other media outlets. The storyteller is Shirley Wong. She grew up in Iowa City, and it's the story of her dad, Lin Wong's friendship with NBA superstar and broadcaster Charles Barkley. And Shirley Wong is here with me now. Hello, Shirley.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So, tell me a little bit about your dad. I know he was an immigrant to the United States. When did he move here?
Yeah, he moved here in the 90s. He was pursuing a PhD at Kansas State, and he studied serial chemistry, which I've never heard of anyone studying serial chemistry except for my dad. But he was really pursuing a career in agriculture. It's what brought us here eventually. And yeah, you know, he was my dad. We had good times, we had silly times, we had times where we argued, and he just really loved basketball. He loved to read, and he loved to just talk to a lot of different people, he sometimes had a bit of a big mouth, I think, as some dads do. But, you know, he always just did his own thing. He didn't really mind being seen as loud or too talkative, and I guess it kind of paid off for him.
When you got older, did you feel like you and your dad had a lot in common? I mean, you're kind of a quiet person, and it sounds like your dad was the opposite. What did the two of you share?
I mean, I think he just showed a genuine curiosity in everyone that he met. He was someone who was always greeting nurses in the hospital, and they would greet him back. He was someone who would start conversations with people just in the elevator. And so I think I also similarly noticed the people around me in really, really intense ways. I really, really love learning about anyone who I come across. And I think that we both are really attuned to that sort of sociality.
This outgoing part of your dad's personality, his curiosity, his sense of humor, that's what led to his friendship with Charles Barkley. And tell me, when you first learned that your dad was friends with Charles Barkley.
Yeah, I mean, my dad just came home one day and started telling me, oh, I met this guy named Charles Barkley in California. And again, I just didn't know who that was at all.
I mean, now that you have learned a great deal more about your dad's friendship with Charles Barkley, tell me how it started and how it developed.
Yeah, so It was the type of dream celebrity encounter. They were at the same hotel. They happened to be at the same hotel in Sacramento. And my dad was walking through the lobby, saw Charles Barkley sitting at the bar, and walked up to him and just asked for a photo. And I don't know what he said after that, but he must have said something that kind of stopped Charles Barkley in his tracks and made him think, maybe I have sort of connection to this guy. And they just talked for hours after that.
Just hung out and talked for hours. And that sounds like an amazing celebrity encounter, but it didn't stop there. I mean, the connection was real. And how did that, even though they didn't live in the same place or really in the same world in so many ways, how did that friendship continue after that first meeting?
My dad would go on different business trips around the United States, and there were certain cities that Charles Barkley said that he frequented. I think they were in New York, Atlanta, Phoenix, and someplace in California. And so he told my dad to shoot him a text whenever he was in those cities. And so my dad took that very seriously, not just as an act of kindness or just a kind of casual gesture.
Right.
And I guess they met up a few times. My dad even visited the studio where they film Inside the NBA at some point, which led to just a wonderful picture where my dad has his arms out behind Shaq and all these famous people. So
yeah. So you decided that you wanted to interview your dad. As an aspiring radio producer, reporter, you decided to interview your dad and record his voice and his thoughts. And so you asked him, and we're going to play a little bit of your dad's voice here. You asked him why he thought he had this connection, why Charles Barkley was interested in being his friend.
I think we had a good conversation. We agree with each other a lot of point of views. So, you know, he was born in 1963. In the 60s and 70s in Alabama, little town called Leeds, Alabama. His father left him and his mother when he was little. He grew up with grandma and mother, and the grandma and mother cleaned up house for somebody else.
So that's your dad sharing just some of his thoughts about why they connected. And it sounds like they had a lot of fun together, but it does sound like they had a deep personal connection. You talked to your dad about it. You've also talked to Charles Barkley about it. So now that you have both sides of the story, what do you think their friendship was about? Why do you think they connected so strongly?
I don't know. I think sometimes people just have the same questions on their hearts and they have the same ideas about how they see the world. And somehow the universe brings them together. I think it was something a little bit supernatural like that, a little bit mysterious.
They were kindred spirits.
Yes, I love that. I love that term a lot. I use that term a lot. And I'm really glad that you just used that term because I kind of feel a little bit wacko when I'm using that. But it's exactly that. They were kindred spirits. And they both decided to act upon that feeling. They both... Charles Barkley generously gave his time to someone who didn't have much of a status in his world, in his celebrity world, but he felt like something was maybe just there and decided to take a chance on that. And I think that's what people really connected to in the story too, just kind of remembering that we do, as humans, as we travel around this earth, we are constantly making those types of connections with people. And so it's important to act upon them, I think.
So your dad got sick and he was diagnosed with cancer. And this is an illness that lasted a long time. Was that what led to you wanting to record your dad's voice, to have these stories to keep?
Yeah.
Your dad didn't tell his friend Charles Barkley that he had cancer, not for a long time, did he?
No, he didn't, no.
But he was mad at your dad for not telling him, right?
Yeah, that was pretty wild to me too, that Charles Barkley said, your dad should have let me know because he wouldn't have been bothering me, because I would have told him if he was bothering me.
Yeah.
And so maybe that whole friendship didn't bother him, which is incredible to me.
Well, it's clear that it didn't. I mean, when your dad passed away just this past June, Charles Barkley showed up at the funeral. So were you expecting him to come?
No, not at all. We were expecting for a very procedural type of funeral, you know. You mourn together, you cry together, you say hi to all the people that you haven't seen for quite a while. And it seems like it's just very set.
Yeah.
And then someone like him walks in, and it's very, very unclear how to react, because at the same time, it's a very somber occasion. It's a funeral. But then all you want to do is just stare and maybe take pictures, but then you know it's a funeral, so it doesn't feel quite right. So it was pretty shocking, and none of us knew how to react. It was just really, really confusing. It sort of changed how we interpreted the rest of the funeral and how we interpreted the rest of the memories that were being shared. I think because we all were able to approach all of the memories being brought up with a new sense of confusion, of a new knowledge that there's always something going on beneath these memories or beneath these stories that are being shared about my dad that we just could not access.
We have a little snippet of what he shared at the funeral. People stood up and they shared memories, and he stood up and shared memories of your dad. Let's listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
When you see the outpouring of love and respect, and the one thing that people have said consistently, he was a selfless man. He really cared about other people. And the world is going to be a little less happier because he's not here. And I was blessed. I think most of you guys and girls have known him a lot longer than me, so y'all got the joy. I've never seen that guy in a bad mood. I mean, I have never seen Lynn in a bad mood. If you're around him, you were laughing the whole time.
Did what he said at the funeral, did it help you see your dad through different eyes, not through the eyes of a daughter, but through the eyes of a friend or of a stranger?
I mean, in those past 2 years, I felt like I was kind of fast-tracking the relationship between my dad and I. Before his illness, I knew him as a dad who was sometimes distant, who didn't speak perfect English, so we didn't always communicate that well, who sometimes yelled at me. And I remember we took this trip to the East Coast to see all these colleges. And during this trip, we went to a beach in Maine. He started doing cartwheels on the beach. And I realized that I reacted with so much surprise. I was kind of just confused about who this person was. And I realized that there was so much more that I didn't know about my dad. So I was sort of getting to know him in that way, in that very fun, friend-like way. And it didn't seem like we totally were able to get to that point before he passed away. It seemed like we had a lot more of our relationship to explore together.
Many more, should have had many more years. This story has resonated with so many people. Has it been hard for you? This pain of losing your dad is so recent and so raw. As exciting as it must be to connect with audiences in this way and to share your dad's story in this way, has it been a difficult experience for you?
I mean, when my dad was first given a terminal diagnosis, I created a Facebook group where I added all my closest friends, and I just told them, I want you to talk about this with me. I want you to send me books. I want you to send me letters. I want you to send me messages that remind me that you're mourning alongside me. And so all I could write about was my dad during that time. It just meant so much to me that I'm a radio journalist, I'm a writer, I can tell this story about my dad, I can fit him into the context of this weird world, I can try to make all these different connections between his life and other people's lives. And I did that through my writing, I did that through my reporting. And I really like to talk about my dad, I really do. And I really like talking about these really intense things that are going on. I like thinking about grieving and mourning because I think people grieve and mourn all the time. And to be able to facilitate this type of conversation and to give something people, put something out there that people really connect to, it's just unbelievable to me. And I think no one knows how to react to a story going so viral. I mean, people are listening to the story in Hong Kong and Australia. I've seen multiple Chinese translations, and WBUR just put out their own Chinese translation. And I am just, I mean, basically during the funeral, all these people pitched in to help. So I just felt this new, incredible sense of love and the way that people can show each other care and the way that people can go out of their ways to make sure that they're acknowledging this really big moment that's happening in the life of someone that they love. And I really felt like I was feeling this new type of love that I'd never felt before. And I felt like I was feeling a new type of sadness that I'd never, ever felt before. Just really, really deep, aching, really dark kind of emotions. And I think in this piece, I try to tie those two elements together and I try to make something beautiful out of that. Mm-hmm. And to be able to do that for myself is really powerful. To be able to do that for so many other people in this world, I mean, that's just a reaction I just never anticipated.
What do you think your dad would think about this story?
I think he would force a lot of people to listen to it. I think that it would be played over and over by him.
You've taken his favorite dinner party story and you've shared it with the whole world.
Yeah.
Seems like he would have loved that a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's just strange because my dad passed away after I graduated from college, after my brother graduated from high school, and after I told him I had an internship this summer at Iowa Public Radio. And so many things were set up right before he passed away. And then now it just feels like he's kind of setting me off on this new path. Even though he's not here, yeah. It really feels like that. It's so strange. It's so weird. All of this is so weird. But it does feel like he's kind of pushing me along. I feel that really deeply.
Shirley, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and with the world.
Thanks for having me here.
Shirley Wong sharing the story of her father, Lin Wong's friendship with NBA superstar and broadcaster Charles Barkley. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. From all of us here at Iowa Public Radio, we wish you happy holidays. I'm Charity Nebbe.